This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Call them the Bonnie and Clyde of jihad. Syed Rizwan Farooq and Tashfeen Malik, a married couple. They did not rob banks, but the arsenal they amassed, according to the FBI, was enough to sustain a terrorist rampage for months. The FBI is suspecting terrorism in this case, and the names of the 14 dead released fit the bill in the sense that they were just innocent county government workers in San Bernardino gunned down during a Christmas party by two radicalized armed terrorists.
These people, they present themselves, and they're really, really true criminals, and they're all over the world, not only in America.
One of the neighbors of the shooters. On Wednesday, San Bernardino Police Chief Jared Bergwan gave reporters a quick tally of just how prepared Farooq and Malik were.
On their person, on their body, and in the vehicle, they had over 1,400 223 caliber rounds that were available to them, and they had over 209 millimeter rounds on their persons as well.
Is there some kind of sickness associated with that sort of home arsenal, collected mostly legally, as far as we know? Gary Slutkin is a former epidemiologist for the World Health Organization and the founder and executive director of Cure Violence. Gary, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So generalize your sense of violence as fitting the pattern of a communicable disease on some level. And can you fit this case into the model that you use to evaluate violence in other places, particularly the inner city?
We look at violence as a contagious disease. It fits the characteristics of a disease, and then it has very characteristic signs and symptoms causing death and or disability. And it's contagious, that is to say, each event seems to lead to more events. Our direct work on this, using this, includes using outreach workers and interrupters who are health workers, the same way that we use health workers for other contagious processes that we see in communities, to detect unusual events or more, in some cases, usual events, and to prevent them from happening and preventing the spread. And our experience of this, which has been in U.S. cities and Latin America and South Africa and even in southern Iraq, shows that we can get between 40% and 70% drops in events.
So if we were to look at this as a public health issue, you would be tracking the amassing of weapons. You would basically track people buying a huge number of bullets and rounds and various handguns and try to figure out what the personal public health dimension of those purchases are and interrupt at that point. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's an interesting way that you're asking that, actually, because, I mean, ordinarily the situation that Cure Violence is working in the U.S. cities, in New York, in Baltimore, in Chicago, and Oakland, and New Orleans, these places, the weapons are everywhere and very easy to access when people want them. So really, we're more looking for events that might happen, thinking more in terms of the people and the situations and the circumstances, because we'd be going out of our mind actually trying to track the weapons. So we're looking for information from friends and family and the community. And people tell us very, very easily because they know that we're, working in everybody's interest. No, people do not have any reason to back off of health workers. And we find out, who was upset at the party last night, who slept with somebody's girlfriend, who was disrespected, who owes somebody money, and then in the case of retaliations, who was in fact shot, and so then who might be thinking of shooting. And I mean, we're virtually 100% effective at preventing retaliations, and like I said, very commonly can make a neighborhood 40-50% safer in a period of just a few months. And some neighborhoods, like in Baltimore, have gone a year, year and a half without shootings and killings using this approach.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the reactions that have come out. There's a New York sheriff who urges gun owners to carry their firearms and actually issued a warning saying that, people who have legal permits should carry them, almost as though if you see something, shoot something. That's sort of the idea. Ulster County, New York, licensed gun owners are urged to carry a firearm to responsibly take advantage of your legal right to carry a firearm in case of incidents like the San Bernardino shooting. Now, does that transmit the virus, for lack of a better word, of violence to have people doing that on the street, or is it a preventive violence prevention tool.
I mean, using basically the science and the data, I mean, this is something that would be expected to make things worse. I mean, we understand it as both an emotional response and something that allows some people to feel a little more protected, but this is the kind of thing that makes things worse because more events will occur.
So this is a transmission notion of violence here to urge people to carry guns. Let's talk about coping right. with the radicalization piece. It seems to me that if you're going to really have an impact on the community trying to be more vigilant about these sorts of shootings and using the information that's come out in San Bernardino and to some extent in Sandy Hook a few years ago, the only thing that's going to work as far as I can tell, and this sounds grim, but is to desanitize the effects of this, that people need to see what that, you know, room looked like after those people were in there. People need to really see in the same way that, you know, people saw Emmett Till's face and suddenly there was a transformed view of violence associated with race in the United States and things began to change. It seems to me that's the only cure for something like this if you want to mobilize citizens.
Well, so there's two parts to this. I mean, what is it that makes for an additional response? You know, the shock as if there hasn't been enough. But really, then it is the other part of what you're asking, which is, you know, what are the appropriate responses that are not emotional, but that are likely to be effective? So there is a missing piece here, which is that there really aren't assigned health workers whose job it is primarily to find likely cases who are either thinking about something now or thinking about who might be earlier on in their evolution towards thinking about something weeks now or months down. Because, of course, there's for any event that's happening, there's others who are thinking about it. Just like for every case of TB, there's someone who is brewing it, you know, who is a few months or weeks away from it activating. And then further on, you know, earlier on in the stream, there's people who have earlier subclinical cases. So when you put a health worker network into place for something like this, which is kind of in the community, has the job of looking for potential cases, you do a lot of good beyond just the finding what's going to happen tomorrow or the next week. But you start to pull people away from being nearer than they are to the line. In other words, we're pulling people back from the likelihood of doing it because we're also talking with people, as we are in neighborhoods and cities in the U.S., we're pulling them further back from the idea that they would do a shooting.
Okay, and so that addresses directly the idea of radicalization, getting some sort of network of health workers to observe the patterns of acquisition of weapons, to think about things that are happening in the neighborhood that might produce violence, and trying to intervene and figure out ways of intervening in advance. Now, would you say that the main impediment to installing a network like that for all kinds of violence in the United States is the NRA that keeps Congress from even studying this as a public health matter?
No, I don't think that's it. I just think that they may be an impediment to some other aspects of this. That have to do with making the firearms less available and accessible. But the part that I've been talking about right now, it really just is a missing piece, which is looking at this as a contagious disease process in the broader scope, and then quite specifically, you know, getting the health sector to be helpful in this. This isn't just a law enforcement issue. This is really a health issue. It's a behavior issue. It's a way of thinking and behaving that's contagious.
And we could start this tomorrow. We could do this tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, there needs to be the right people selected and the right people trained, and the training has to be exactly a certain way. This is what Cure Violence does, is it really knows how to select the right people who have access and trust, and then to train them in persuasion and cooling down and changing thinking and doing the behavior change and making it really click and staying with people. These are the things law enforcement, then they have the time to do, is really work with the populations in a trained way to help them change thinking. And we change thinking all the time, whether it's about smoking or eating or exercise or drunk driving or Yeah, I mean, sexual behavior, I mean, changing behavior and changing thinking is really the bread and butter of the health sector.
Gary Slutkin is a former epidemiologist for the World Health Organization and the founder and director of Cure Violence. Gary, it's great to have a discussion that doesn't require us to focus on the NRA and the political stalemate in Washington. These are things that could happen immediately if we begin thinking differently about violence. Gary, thanks so much.
Thank you.